an organization, a leader, being just a passive victim, to be actually, in fact, an active agent. So that's, thank you.
Can I quickly go and answer the door if you're going to cut? Because somebody's ringing my doorbell and it's not stopping.
Yeah.
I'll be back.
Yeah. I thought, well, what's going on? Is it me?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Welcome to Scenarios for Tomorrow, a podcast where we turn tomorrow's headlines into today's thought experiments. This first series includes conversations with the authors of our latest book, Improving and Enhancing Scenario Planning, Futures Thinking Volume, from Edward Elgar Publishing. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Crawford, and throughout this first series, you'll hear from my guests the numerous global techniques for practicing and advancing scenario planning. Enjoy!
Today, we are lucky to have three guest authors with us. Maureen Meadows is Professor of Strategic Management in the Center for Business and Society at Coventry University. She co-leads the research cluster Data Organization and Society. Maureen's background is in big data, customer analytics, and governance of data, where she has worked as both practitioner and academic. If you're interested in learning more, you can purchase her latest book, which is the second edition of Strategy, Theory, Practice, and Implementation from Oxford University Press. Frances O'Brien is an associate professor of operational research and analytics at Warwick Business School, my alma mater, where she teaches across undergraduate, MBA, and executive education. Her work looks at the use of tools such as scenario planning to support organizational strategic development. Frances's background includes working at Ford of Europe, which is a subsidiary of Ford Motor Company, as their operational research analyst, specializing in simulation modeling, manpower planning, and optimization. And the third member of our panel today is Alessandro Medendito. He is a lecturer in accounting at Queen Mary University in London and a qualified charter accountant member of the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales. Alessandro's work focuses on digital integration, particularly how big data and AI are shaping strategic decisions and digital strategies. And after all that, welcome everyone. It's very great to have you here today.
Thanks, Megan.
Given the hurricane path, right, that our book took, which is about 2 years and change, there's never really been a good chance for Alessandro and I to meet, and that is until today. So welcome to our inner circle, Alessandro.
Thank you, Megan. I'm grateful to be here.
Great. And Maureen and Frances, now you've been working together for years in your professional capacity and have impacted the field of scenario planning on several fronts, including both of your works have influenced my research and will continue to influence my research. And I'm very grateful for it. And particularly in that, not just the practice of scenario planning, but now in a broader sense of foresight and futures thinking. So welcome. As mentioned in the introduction, we've just published a book together about scenario planning in the 21st century. And here in 2025, right at the quarter century mark, we're here to talk a bit about that. We understand that not all of our listeners are familiar with scenario planning or scenario planners, though they may have heard more about it since the pandemic when we got extremely popular. And one of the motivations to this podcast is to bring our world of futures and foresight science outside the walls of academia, where within language is closely controlled and knowledge is not as easy to access as we generally wish it to be, which just means we're here to have a chat with the public. So let's get into it. Your chapter in the book is titled In the Thick of It, Scenario Planning at a Time of Crisis. You are, I do believe, the only chapter that really brings in the concepts that you discuss, which is an incredible addition to the overall narrative. So let's start at a grounding level, right? How do you define scenario planning?
So I think I'm answering this question, or at least I'm starting off. So scenario planning is a methodology, by which I mean it's a series of steps that people follow, typically as a group, participatively, facilitated by an expert scenario planner. And it's a methodology which seeks to develop a set of scenarios which are then used for some purpose by the group. So a scenario is a description or a story of a possible future. And scenarios are typically presented as sets to acknowledge that the future is uncertain. If you were to just create a single story about the future, that would be equivalent to a forecast. But given that we don't know what the future will contain, how it will develop, the idea is that you develop a set of scenarios, typically between 2 and 4, is what the literature says is useful for people to manage. And you develop this set in order to try to capture the uncertainty about the future. So we don't know what the future might look like. We are not simply going to project historical patterns, because historical patterns don't always replicate themselves, and things happen that we don't necessarily anticipate or foresee. So the idea with the set of scenarios is you capture a range of uncertainty about multiple different factors or elements. Some people might call them variables, but these might be factors or elements, typically about the external environment. So we're creating stories about what the future world out there might look like that an organization or a group may have to contend with in their work. So I said scenario planning is a methodology that develops scenarios and then uses them. So I think it's really helpful to consider those two stages when you're talking about scenario planning. It's not just about creating the stories, but about thinking, what do those stories mean for us? And one of the key concepts that's associated with scenario planning is the notion of robustness. If we are going to plan how our organization might develop in the future, and we don't know what that future might be like, then it's a good idea that our plans are robust in that they can cope with whatever the future might throw at us. And that's why we develop a set of scenarios, so that we can test our plans and our thinking about the future to check that they can cope with a variety of different situations, because we don't know which situation will come to pass. How's that?
It's excellent.
Anyone want to add anything with everything else?
I think that's great. Just a couple of thoughts, which we may get into. It's, you know, the arguments are often made, aren't they, about the benefits of actually engaging in the scenario planning, and that by considering alternative futures, it changes the mindsets of those who participate. And to me, that's always been a very important argument. And maybe we'll get into that as we talk about the case study in a bit.
Oh, I'm sure we will. In fact, I'm sure we're about to get into it right now. So what you bring up, Francis, is that scenario planning is a process. It's multi-parts. It's involved. And it's about looking towards the future. It is, I would say, always. Am I agreeing with you on this one? That it's always about looking towards the future? Yeah, good enough. Maybe not.
You're just challenging my thinking there. I was just thinking, oh, that's an interesting idea. Is it always about the future? Might it ever be about the past?
Can we have uncertainty about the past? There's a question. Spend an hour talking about that one. Yeah.
An incredible point that is brought up by others as well. Taking that into the context of your chapter. Your chapter about scenario planning at a time of crisis. So something we know from the inside, you know, the sort of secret conversations we have, is that we understand that our field becomes exceptionally popular
at times of crisis compared to before the crisis and as well after, you know, whatever is assumed to be after a crisis. So this is the future you bring into your Futures and Foresight chapter. And I'd like to then get pass the mic over. I'd like to hear your thoughts about the story of crisis as a process, as opposed to crisis as an event, right? And what it can look like and how it can be experienced from our side of the futures thinking. Alessandra, would you like to take this one?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a very good point, and it's how in our study, we adopted this perspective. We adopted the perspective that crisis is not a one-off event, but rather is a process that unfolds over time with multiple phases and multiple decision points. So, and this is particularly relevant for sectors like the museums, which is the sector that we are looking at in this research, where the effects of a crisis such as COVID-19 ripple across funding, across staffing, audience engagement, and strategic direction. So seeing a crisis as a process allows us to move away from the idea of a single shock moment, and instead allows us to focus on how leaders can meaningfully intervene throughout the life cycle of a crisis. So, for example, it's quite useful for leaders, instead of asking how do we recover from the crisis, because we can tell that we are always in a crisis, so it's a process. Probably this process-oriented view asks how do we understand and act within a crisis and as it develops. So that's this definition of a crisis as a process rather than a one single event was pretty useful for our project on scenario planning, because scenario planning, as my colleagues Francis and Maureen said, is a process, and exactly like the crisis, which is exactly the context that we have looked at during our project.
Okay. And to be honest, it almost feels like when we look back at these big moments, we talk about them through a processional episodic memory retrieval kind of relaying. So crisis as a process, it brings, and that matches, that really I would say seems to be supported well by something like scenario planning, right? Which is this multi-approach system that looks at a bunch of different qualities of the problem.
Yeah, and if I may, sorry, there's another point. Mm-hmm. So, and this framing is also particularly useful because this framing as crisis as a process rather than a single shock moment is particularly useful because it emphasizes that organizations and leaders are not just passive victims of external shocks. In fact, they are active agents who can shape their responses and adjust course and learn from what is happening in real time. So having this perspective, it really shifts from an organization, a leader being just a passive victim to be actually, in fact, an active agent.
Right. So that is something that I don't think we discuss much about in that kind of framing. You know, we think, understandably so, a lot of our discussions kind of, you know, between us, but also when we talk to the media or talking with a client when we're, you know, consulting or anything like that, is in more simplistic terms. Like, here's a tool. It's going to do a thing for you at this time. But what's really happening is we're looking at this whole process perspective, this whole systems perspective. And it's hard to break that down. So I do appreciate that we're getting a chance to share that today. Now, with that said, your chapter specifically did look at, it discusses a case study, the museum sector, and how COVID-19, our most recent pandemic, impacted the sector. So would you walk us through that a little bit? Give us a little introduction.
Yeah, so the pandemic created a sudden existential threat to the whole sector because the whole sector, like many others, was relying on physical, on people, on physical programs and exhibitions. So museums were forced to close, leading to furloughs, redundancies, and a total disruption to physical programming, which was still is for some their main business model. So, and many institutions lacked robust digital infrastructure and were suddenly asked to pivot overnight. That was quite challenging. And it wasn't just about putting collections online. So it wasn't just about upload a picture online. It was about rethinking what engagement, education, or community connection could look like in a digital space. It was tremendously tough and difficult and challenging for the museum sector. And if we think that it's just this has to be done with very limited time and no resources, or very limited resources. And also the crisis, the COVID-19 and the crisis also expose existing inequalities within the sector. So if you think about larger museums or larger and better funded museums compared to your smaller and local ones. So that was this is the sector, this is the environment where our research fit in. So this sector deeply affected to, from the crisis and COVID-19.
Okay, so yeah, let's go even deeper into that then. So here's scenario planning. Some people consider it a process, so almost more conceptual. Some people consider it a tool. I believe y'all speak about it a little bit of both in your chapter. Maureen, specifically, like scenario planning as a tool in these times where it's fast decision making, fast changeovers, unexpected changeovers, and having hardly a time to sort of stress test, a lot of what's coming. You're specifically a we, but in this situation, you're specifically working with leadership, right? Because they're the decision makers, they're the ones who have the final say. So, how was scenario planning this useful tool with the leadership during COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting. The first thing was that we found people did want to talk to us, which wasn't, would not have been obvious at the beginning. This was an incredibly stressful time for them, as Alessandro's already said. They were shut. They had lost all their income streams. Staff were furloughed, staff working at home, trying to figure out, if you remember those days, how to use Zoom, how to record a podcast, all those things that we became, quickly very familiar with. And they really wanted to have that conversation because the other thing you might remember from those days was what is the future going to look like? Is it, this question, is it going to go back to normal? Or everyone was talking about a new normal, right? What will the new normal be? And again, in those workshops, the managers were saying things like, "Will people want to come back? If we put things online, maybe people won't want to come back again into music." Which again sounds a little bit crazy. We know that a few years on, we know that people have gone back. But I guess my point is, people did want to have those conversations. I think it comes back to this notion of crisis, yeah, and I think one definition of crisis is the point when you really don't know what to do, right? You're almost at maximum uncertainty, and you're probably stressed and baffled, and really wondering what the right route is. And so we found the scenario process to be a really good one for talking through, obviously what those different futures might look like. And what they could do starting from where they were starting from. And it's worth saying that the museums we talked to, there was a wide range from some large, well-resourced institutions that you definitely know the name of, through to some little local ones with, even less resources. So there was a huge worry about the right resources and capabilities to respond to these challenges. And the scenario process, I agree with you, it's a process and a tool, I think, Megan. It really did help. I'm interested in how you have a good strategic conversation. That's one of the things that, one of the questions that's run through my research for years, and I've felt it really did help. really did help with that.
Yes. And that exercise of having not just a strategic conversation, which is an entire, I don't know, subset of what a conversation can even be, but a good, a meaningful strategic conversation, right? That is something that's coming into question a lot with a lot of the digital tools that people are trying to use to support scenario planning, right? The most obvious one being various AI tools. It's like, okay, what does that mean to the strategic conversation that we have assumed in this in the field and in the practice, that the study of it is a key part of the success, right? Is that well, 1 on 5, 1 on 7,000 conversations that we have. Right. Okay. So you had large museums that you were working with. So they had, and then small, local, regional, they had different budgets, they had different concerns, they had similar but different fears, right? And COVID added one more thing to that with this ability to have conversations with them, which is we had to take a hybrid approach, or we had to take a fully virtual approach. We had to change even the way we approach scenario planning as scenario planners. How'd that work out for you? What were some of the things you took away from that?
So we did have to run the exercise virtually. We didn't meet any of these people in person until much later. But we used the word hybrid in the chapter because, well, we're using it in a slightly different way, actually. We're dealing with the fact that the participants were very time poor, just extremely busy, you know, as I say, stressed, short-term future, the survival of the organization in some cases, you know, it was that bad. And, you know, so we worked very hard to get them to engage in the workshops. And as I said, they did appreciate the conversation, but we're using hybrid in a slightly different sense. I mean, a scenario planning exercise is can be done in a number of ways, right? And the literature often presents the ideal way of running a scenario planning exercise is to involve people, involve the participants right from the beginning, right through to the end in every step, right? From brainstorming, generating scenarios, using the scenarios and coming up with the strategies and this whole process. Not every scenario exercise is like that. Francis and I have written about scenario use. So what it's like when you get participants to engage with a set of existing scenarios that they haven't been part of developing, and they need to orientate themselves sometimes in order to use the scenarios effectively, you need to ground yourself in them. So we were very aware of these arguments. You know, ideally you'd use people, you'd get people involved throughout the process, because that's perhaps how the mindset change happens. Those arguments about, you know, look, the participants look at the world differently, even if the scenarios themselves, they don't feel useful, the process is, right? Those kind of arguments. We couldn't do that. We couldn't do a whole day in person, or you know, it just wasn't an option during COVID. So Alessandro and I designed a process where we ran a couple of workshops up front, where we got them to do brainstorming the elements in the external environment. Listeners might be familiar with PEST, political, economic, social, technological, those kinds of frameworks for saying what's going on in the external environment. We did that. We then took away all the output from those conversations, and Alessandro and I designed the scenarios. And then we ran a second set of workshops where the scenarios were used and the strategies were developed. So it was this little bit of a halfway house. Some participants stayed with us. They came to one of the first workshops, and they came to the scenario use type workshops. Some, you know, didn't do the first and did the second, or vice versa. So it was a very interesting exercise from that point of view. It's often how it would happen in an organization, by the way, isn't it? If you were running a consultancy exercise for a company, again, not everybody can make every meeting because they're busy, time poor managers. So we tried to design the process to work in that way, entirely online. And I think by and large it did, because when we came to the scenario use workshops, as we mentioned in the chapter, people did recognize, the people who'd been at the earlier workshops were saying, you know, I recognize that. I can see you've taken some of the debates we had at that early workshop are reflected in the scenarios and so on. So for us, it was quite an interesting exercise that was kind of, as I say, kind of a halfway house between the full you're involved from A to Z or just giving you a set of scenarios that you haven't been involved in developing at all.
Yeah, that is a point of contention a lot between us, just as researchers and practitioners. You know, do we be dogmatic and have like the same, first of all, have a leadership team, you know, involved? And do we make them be involved the whole time or consider it a failure effort? Or yeah, do we factor in, as the term that I think is a great term, time poor nature of these clients, right?
The other point, sorry, Megan, is of course this wasn't an exercise for one organisation. It was for a bunch of museums, right, you know, across the West Midlands. So Alessandra and I were not in a position to insist, right, and say, right, there wasn't a single senior management team that we could talk to, you know.
Because these were like boards, right? I mean, museums are run by boards and trusts and things of that nature, right?
So our participants, we had some directors, some CEOs, some chief operating officers, some heads of digital or heads of marketing. You know, in some of the small museums, it was only a very small senior team anyway. You know, there weren't too many individuals you could reach out to. So yeah, that was the level we were aiming at, those sort of senior decision makers who were interested in strategy and digital going forward.
Okay. Well, okay, so you then, you know, your team, y'all bring in something else that's also, at least from my perspective, seemed a little different from the norm as well. The way you said you did this hybrid approach, you were using almost like the crisis of application into being flexible and saying, okay, we can have these people here and some people there, and we're going to do like this stage of scenario and then that stage of scenario. But you also use this technique within, which is you didn't make the scenario planning about the organizations you were working with. You used a fictional museum, right? A fictional organization. And I haven't personally come across that outside of when you're just teaching about scenario planning, right? But even then, we bring in real governments or something, you know, so people can do the research. So I would love to hear more about that. What was the motivation behind it? How did it work out? What was the effect of it? Yeah.
Yeah, so we created, so we broke the rules, but that was a deliberate and strategic choice, and we'll explain why. So we created this fictional, we call it West Midlands Museum, WMM. And as I said, it was a deliberate and strategic choice. And the key idea was to allow for open and honest reflection across a group of diverse institutions without putting any one museum or leader under the spotlight. So, and by using this fictional organization, participants could explore difficult scenarios or even complex decisions without feeling that they, as leaders, or their organizations were being judged. And that was quite powerful because that gave them space to reflect critically and creatively rather than defensively. So the way we created this fictional museum, we ran some workshops before to, as Maureen said, we ran this personal analysis and the conversations with the organizations, with the leaders. And then we analyzed the data and we built this fictional museum. So this fictional museum is based on what our participants said, and it's based on the two main external variables that, or two external factors that the leaders seen as an important. So, and probably, as I said, this is quite, there was quite a very
good exercise, because creating this fictional organization, because using a fictional organization avoided competitiveness, for example, or finger pointing, which can easily emerge in a sector-based discussions. So instead of creating this safe imaginative space where participants could discuss strategy, I could see their organization in this fictional museum. That was quite powerful. And so also this exercise allowed leaders and museum leaders to test assumptions and consider different organizational responses. As I said, this fictional West Midlands Museum, the WMM, allowed for, as I said, honest and sector-wide reflection without implicating any one institution. And participants could engage with the strategy narratives more freely without feeling defensive or without feeling too exposed. And to be fair, many CEOs, so we run these workshops with the CEOs and senior director of the senior management teams. And so they said that they saw their own organizations reflected in our fictional museum. And that opened up strategic conversations about responses. It works quite well. And also we had very positive feedback from our participants. So it wasn't too far away. It wasn't too far-fetched organization.
If I can just add a little bit to that. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it comes up. It is an important issue, this one, because, as you say, Megan, scenarios are traditionally pictures of the external environment, aren't they? But, you know, it just comes back to that crisis situation. I think people were very much wanted to talk about, there's a real sense of urgency and a real sense of thinking of being constrained by their own lack of resources. And so purely talking about the external environment without talking about how getting quite quickly into how they could respond and the constraints on their response, you know, that wouldn't have been a useful conversation for them. So we wanted to make it as engaging and as plausible as possible is how I would put it, I think.
Yeah, that whole business of how you create meaningful, engaging, relatable, plausible, you could insert any adjective there, and the scenario literature is full of lots of adjectives that says what makes a good scenario. But I think one of the points that will come out a little bit later as well is it's context dependent. And I think what we've got a good example here of is how Maureen and Alessandro really thought about not following some notion of on paper scenario planning has to be done this way, but they adapted it and they modified it to suit the needs of the context and of the stakeholders involved, and that's why they made the choices that they did.
Yes, this, just from a purely selfish point of view, I hadn't planned. I didn't think y'all were going to write about this. And when I saw it, I was like, heck yes, because we are really talking about what are we doing now in this evolution of the field compared to where we've come from in the last 60, 70 years, right? And breaking the mold is happening. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on using this technique outside of scenario planning and crisis, right? So day-to-day scenario planning. What do you recommend this kind of, what would you say, third-person perspective almost in the work?
I think there's a lot of different ways. I'll start, you two chip in. I think there's a lot of different ways that you think about how you're going to present your scenarios. And I think this is an area that's really ripe for research, and I don't see an awful lot written about precisely how you present the scenarios and what you populate them with beyond the individual factors or variables, whatever people call them, that you've brainstormed in the early part of the process. And I think it really, I think the answer has to be it depends. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on who's involved, the context, the time and space, and what's going out, what's going on around you, that affects those decisions, as well as the purpose. What is the purpose of the exercise? And here, it was about giving people a tool to. I don't want to say take their minds off the immediacy of the thing, but it was almost about lifting their heads up, and seeing a way into a time beyond the crisis. I mean, one of the things that one of the other features of this exercise, where they broke the rules, if you like, was there was no date on the scenario. So the scenarios, although they were set in the future, they weren't set at a particular point in time, or you know, with a particular endpoint trajectory, and I think that again was another conscious decision. But that doesn't mean that they're not scenarios as we would call them, because they are clearly they're clearly descriptions of alternative possible futures that describe a different time zone, even though they might not describe a particular date or you know, specific years. There's clearly a feeling of a different period that these futures are set in. And again, I think that was a conscious decision that was influenced by the setting and the people involved.
I mean, just to add a little bit to that on the timing, you know, we've probably all met resistance. I know working with other groups, I've met resistance. If you ask them to think too many years out, they say, oh, I can't possibly do that. You know, I work in a fast moving industry. I can't predict 3 months, 6 months. Don't ask me to talk about it, you know. So we were partly getting over that, you know, that they were so much in the COVID crisis that we didn't push them. Say, oh, you know, think 5 years, 20 years out. But Francis is right. We were painting a picture of a world beyond the crisis without putting, as Francis just pointed out, we didn't put a number on it, but we were still gently getting them to think about a world, a time beyond the crisis, which if you think back to the COVID days, we didn't know how long it was going to take to play out, you know, how many lockdowns there were going to be, etc. So that was a way of, I guess, a way of dealing with that very extreme uncertainty, I guess.
Right. I mean, that was some of the work that George and I did. We were looking at, I could be wrong, but at the time we had the largest review of COVID scenarios. It was the first half, but it was a monster half of 2020. And I mean, people were focused on 2 weeks, 2 months, you know. You had some, there were plenty, you know, in that database that went a whole year out. But that short-term perspective, and you put me in mind of another place where the short-term and almost like jumping from one anxious, I don't want to quite call it a crisis, but people do talk about it in the exact same terms, when scenario planning or forecasting, even, which is more in that quantitative world, is when you're dealing with politics, politicians and policymakers, because they are so focused on the election cycle. Like, that's their time where they can guarantee their ability to do whatever it is they're trying to do, right? Election cycles can be a year and a half, you know, or 4 years. I mean, in the US, they're set. In the UK, there are snap elections, but that in itself is a limiting factor. You know, when you're thinking, it's like, oh, they could call an election anytime. So there's that short term. And I really liked that you tried something different with that. Okay, so this is one of the fun things, right, about bringing in a case study, is you've got outcomes. That is something researchers like I and many, especially in scenario planning, struggle and rage against, as we don't get the chance to follow up with a lot of things, it's a lot of theory papers, understandably so, discussion papers, review papers, very few empirical papers, but the empirical papers are largely often laboratory based, right? So we're testing out very small situations. And as Francis said, probably every single one of those papers reduces to, it depends. It's so context dependent. And that's not a bad thing, but it's good to recognize, right? So y'all had not just one client, you had an industry. So I'm going to pass the mic back. I want to hear what happened with all these breaking the molds and new methods.
So shall I talk about some of the themes that came out of our data, and Megan, would that be
absolutely
that'd be useful? So we picked up our two major themes, and we did what many scenario planners do and use those as the two axes that make up, you know, that give you the four sort of the four scenarios in the quadrants. So we had an awful lot of qualitative data. We analysed and transcribed. We transcribed and analysed all the sessions that we did. And the first big theme that we kept coming back to, we summarised as digital is about people. And what did we mean by that? The museums were sort of obsessed with their audiences, their visitors, the needs and the wants of those audiences. You know, where. Were people going to enjoy digital activities? Were they going to enjoy them so much that they'd never come back through the door of a museum again? Or was there going to be some future where they were, doing both? So we talked an awful lot about that, about how they were going to serve their audiences in a digital world post-COVID, and what, you know, what a hybrid strategy in the sense of a mix of digital and in-person might look like. And it was also interesting talking to these museum specialists, just how rooted in people and stories they were. So they saw museums, you know, not as a building with objects in it. They saw museums as all about engagement, all about dialogue, all about their local communities and telling stories and so on. So there was a very much people driven account of, you know, of their purpose and why they were there, what their strategy should be. So that was really the first thing. And the second one we summed up as digital is not free. So we've already said that these organisations are typically, they're not well resourced. Some of the big museums might be more so, but many are not. Many are really struggling. They're operating on really tight budgets. And while they wanted to go down a digital route, there was a cost associated with that. And they were very interested in what the funding landscape would look like in the future as well, because they felt that many of the traditional funders in this space funded based on visitor numbers. You know, it literally had to be, you know, bums on seats, as it were, people coming through the door. And they were saying, well, how's that going to work in a, you know, if we go more further down the digital route? Maybe we're really great on TikTok and we've got millions of followers on TikTok, but what does that do to our funding streams as well? So very concerned about the cost of digital, and very concerned about what the funding landscape for them looked like in the future in terms of just winning resources for their digital activities. So those were the two big themes that we summed up. Digital is about people and digital isn't free.
I'm just trying to think where else you took that. So you had this new space. So how did your clients or your participants, I think I've been referring to them as clients and you've been referring to them as participants, but how do they, like, you know, balance this need for digital innovation with their concerns about the funding and the resources? And I even showed you a mic earlier I had, right? That was my COVID mic, but I only had that one because it was the only one left in all the electronic stores in the area. It was it. And I was shamed for even walking into the store. Fair enough. I get it. But, like, yeah, I mean, there was constraints beyond constraints on so many levels. So how'd that go? How'd they deal with that?
Yeah, that's, as I said, balancing the need for digital innovation with concerns about funding and resource constraints. It's that was a struggle. That was a constant tension. So, and indeed, this balancing innovation, digital innovation with limited resources, was one of the most pressing challenges. Participants or clients, participants were pretty candid about their financial constraints facing the sector. Many museums were still struggling with basic operational costs. And we know digital strategies often require significant upfront investments, and many museums weren't ready to do that. Weren't not ready, not just from a cognitive point of view. What I mean by that they didn't, they were too scared to invest in that. But some museums were not ready from a financial point of view. They didn't have sufficient budget, sufficient money to invest in this new world. However, there was a broad agreement that digital innovation was no longer optional. So there was the majority of our participants say, yeah, that digital innovation is not luxury. It's not a luxury. It's actually, it needs to be central. So leaders spoke about needing to be pragmatic and finding good enough solutions. For example, experimenting with affordable tools and pursuing collaborations with mainly external partners to stretch capacity. So the pandemic and the COVID-19 was actually for many like an opportunity to experiment and try new collaborations, exactly to balance these constraints, the balance between the need for digital innovation and the resource constraints. And so some museums began rethinking what constitutes value, for example, in a museum context, recognizing, for example, that digital engagement, even if imperfect, could create meaningful experiences also for well-being, mental well-being, and especially for audiences who cannot or may not or might not return on site for different reasons. So there was the emphasis shifted from perfection of digital innovation to progress. And of course, the concerns about the affordability of digital actions as a result of digital strategies was present. And just to finish on this, as I said, they advocated for digital to be central rather than a luxury for their organization and then for the sector.
Okay. As we've come to experience, you know, sort of proof of concept here, is we've really embraced that digital space now and that digital ways of doing things, and a lot of companies have responded to streamline that. Streamlining being another way of make it cheaper and easier. But yeah. And we see AI sneaking into it now as part of this digital support space.
And again, just to say, there was a huge spectrum. I think, you know, for some of the smaller museums that we dealt with, they were doing very little on digital before COVID. You know, even their website was pretty bad, let's say. The website was a place you might go to check opening times or something, plan your visit, and that was about it, you know, through to a whole range of some of the bigger museums who were doing really exciting things with, I don't know, virtual tours, even, you know, virtual reality for school visits and all kinds of things. So it really did come back to them building. We found building some of their resources and their capabilities, and taking the next step, trying some different approaches based on the resources and capabilities than they could muster at the time.
Yeah, exactly. You got me thinking about all these new things I've been doing a lot of the websites absolutely got bumped up in quality and information, the UX, UI designs, all that good stuff. You know, a lot of that was considered luxuries. You know, these were technologies of luxury. But the luxury technologies are often it's coded for accessibility, you know, and that accessibility is often relegated to the luxury space. So you need a lot of money. You need to be, you know, well-backed. You need to be well-informed in order to get all this. And now this knockoff effect of all these things is people are having access in ways that didn't before and are able to have more meaningful, hopefully, exciting experiences for it.
I'd just add one thing to that would be about the relationship with schools, though, Megan, between because a very important audience for museums is school visits. And that's an income stream for them and so on. And so they started, you know, COVID came. Schools couldn't come and clearly couldn't come and visit. You had staff at home. So they were trying simple things to start with. They were saying, let's do a Zoom lecture, you know, which will be available to the school kids. These sorts that worked okay for a little while, but we all got sick of Zoom pretty quickly, if you remember. You know, we're spending too many hours on. So some of them were, again, we're innovating, and it was the mixture between the digital and the physical that was quite nice. So some of the museums started putting together a box with some of the items from the museum in, which could go out, and you know, when kids could come back to school, or some of the kids who were in school because their parents were key workers, because they could interact with objects from the museum in a box alongside some sort of online activities. So it's sort of thinking, it's not just about taking what was done in person and putting it online, you know, and some of the museums, I think Alex referred earlier to taking photos of all the objects and putting them on the website. You know, it's thinking beyond that, isn't it? What else, you know, what else can we do? What else can the digital world allow us to do? And that's shaken up the relationship between museums and schools as well, we think.
Well, that's excellent. Oh, I love hearing that. This is what I love about case studies. We get to hear all the like actual outcomes that happened. Okay, so I know we're running short on time. We've probably gone over time, which is always, I find that a good thing. We're just having a good conversation about stuff. But there's one question I really, really did want to make sure we had time for. And it's from everything that y'all have been talking about. You know, you learned, you broke some molds, you tried some new stuff, you brought in experimentation, you brought in this third party kind of perspective, you brought in all these things, and you got to work with a lot of clients at the same time, a lot of organizations. So, but that was within that industry, right? Are there, and I bet there are there broader lessons that you can tell us about that other industries could learn from this case study about using scenario planning during a crisis?
I'll start here. I think the first thing that you have to do whenever you want to use scenario planning is you have to understand what you're dealing with. So you have to understand the background context to what's going on. So here we had the background context was COVID had shut down the museums and it had created a time of crisis. And that had several implications. That meant that the various participants were not only time poor, they were quite anxious. They were very focused on the here and now. And it was in thinking, how can we use scenario planning to support this particular or these particular circumstances that led to the process that was actually deployed? And I think that's the biggest lesson for me, or if you like, the first lesson that is the takeaway, is that really needs to be upfront in any scenario processes. What is it all about? You know, what are we trying to do here? What is the purpose? And that reminds me of some of the stuff I read of, you know, from Kees van der Heijden. He was really big on purposeful scenario planning. And so I think that's really the starting point in terms of lessons to take away. There's various things that were tried. So it wasn't a question of you take the methodology and the tool out of the box and then you churn the handle as if you were making sausages or something. It's very much understanding the different aspects of the scenario process and thinking, well, if we've got really time poor people, which bits do we really need them to engage in and which bits could we take away and develop ourselves? So I think there's a whole load of questions that start from that purposeful reflection that can be taken away. Let me stop there and see whether Maureen or Alessandro want to chip in and take any of those points or bring in some other points.
I was just going to say this idea of creating the fictional organisation. I don't think I'd do that if I was working for one client. I can't imagine that working with one client. But obviously, with the sectoral perspective, I think that was a way of solving that problem, because working with quite such a range of clients is quite a challenge. You know, they were all facing this crisis, but they were in very different positions. So yeah, that was one point I wanted to make. It could, that notion of the fictional organisation could work in other situations where you've got multiple clients or an industry or an industry there. And again, just on that point of having a fictional organisation in the scenarios, and again, a purist would say, you know, the organisation shouldn't be in the scenario. I think one of the things that frustrates me with some scenario exercises is you have beautiful scenarios that are not used, right? So it comes back to Francis's purposeful point. It's a tool for use. It's a process to take people through. And I think if by putting an organization in the scenarios, you make the use aspects of it clearer, because you're actually talking about, you know, the strategies that the organization is choosing and the resources and the capabilities that it does or doesn't have. So for me, I suppose I'm sort of saying it's a price worth paying, right? You bend the rules in order to make the use aspects of the scenario work better. I hope that makes sense.
And just the two art, I know that my colleagues already had much. So just another additional broader lesson is this study shows that scenario planning is not just about long-term futures. So in times of disruption or crisis, scenario planning can help organizations to shift from reactive responses to proactive strategies, even between uncertainty, even amid uncertainty. So that's one point. And the second is scenario planning during a crisis must be responsive to participants' lived experiences or lived realities. So that's why we run workshops before that. And it needs to be faster and probably more focused than action oriented. So that's probably for me the two broader lessons that can other industries can learn from this study.
Okay. Something else we were doing with the scenarios, I think, was challenging the functional silos, just to say. But a lot of the, for a lot of the participants, they would say that in their museums, digital was something, it was a certain person's problem, you know, so digital's in the IT department, or digital's in marketing, you know, they're trying to sell tickets or do a bit of social media or something. And one of the things that very strongly came out of this as a strategic conversation is digital has to be a golden thread that runs through the whole organization. You know, your digital strategy isn't a separate strategy. It is part of the strategy. You know, it has to be absolutely integrated into everything that the organization's doing. And yeah, so I think that was an important learning and something that came out very strongly from the conversations with the museum leaders.
Yeah, that's something you see pop up and maybe this is what they mean when they talk about whole systems thinking. You know, we got to think about the entire organization and the environment and the stakeholders, all of it. But yes, Francis, I think I cut you off earlier.
No, you're okay. I was going to just bring in the time horizon bit and just say, you know, if that is proving a barrier in your exercise, then why do you need to put a date on it? Because what you are creating is images of a different time. And if there is a sense that here there was clearly, you know, a zone of crisis, which was whilst the pandemic lasted, but then there was clearly a time beyond that that the scenarios were set in. So would a time horizon on that have really been helpful? We don't know how long the crisis was going to last. So I think that's an interesting notion to take away, is that that scenario planning is a very, well, there isn't one scenario planning method. I think you know, that's one thing that it's really important to understand, is that there are many different approaches to doing scenario planning as there are practitioners doing it, really. I mean, there might well be schools where different processes share things in common. But there are a huge variety of different processes out there. So if I were talking to people who were thinking about designing a scenario process, you know, this notion that you can mix and match, that you can challenge preconceived ideas about what a scenario process has to look like, is very much something to be encouraged. Yeah.
To end, everybody gets this question, because mostly I'm excited. I like to hear what everybody has to say, but I think it's like one of the things we're really good at answering in a really exciting way. What trends are you seeing in your area of work right now?
I think one of the biggest ones, the most obvious ones, is the impact of AI. Gen AI, you know, how can that be brought into scenarios? Is it a replacement for humans? Is it a support for humans? What role does AI have to play in the development of scenarios? I think that's a really exciting topic, which some people are already exploring in our field, but I think that one's ripe for further development.
I think I'd just say, one of the things that I think managers, decision makers are wrestling with, it's an obvious one, but it's speed of change and volatility and extreme uncertainty, isn't it, across so many fronts. And, you know, I think our methods like scenario planning are sometimes put in the box of, you know, some of your old fashioned strategic planning methods that are too slow, too rigid, are not going to help in situations of rapid change and great volatility, right? And I think they can, and I think researchers in our space are thinking about, you know, scenario planning in different contexts. As Francis said earlier, it's all about the context, isn't it? And taking an outline of a method and adapting to situations of rapid change, situations of high volatility, that sort of thing. So I think those conversations are happening, and I'm really excited to see what comes out of that.
Two things probably. One is the cognitive, we talked about cognitive or cognition psychology, and it's something that I'm quite passionate about, is the cognition and how directors think. And I think scenario planning can be a tool, a real tool for them to think strategically. And to be more precise, so in my view, something that we not talk about enough is the cognitive load on leaders and teams navigating this transformation, these changes, this crisis. So there's a lot of emphasis of tools, of platforms, or outputs, but not much on thinking space, or how we can support leaders. Leaders need to make sense of changes. They need to challenge assumptions, and then they reimagine their institutions. And sometimes we don't focus much on this, cognitive process. That's one aspect. The second is the failure, something we also saw, the fear of failure, and we don't discuss openly enough. And so also creating this fictional organization really helped to start in unpacking their failure. But there is a real fear in the sector or in general about getting wrong, and specifically or particularly with public money involved. But we know if we want innovation or digital innovation, and if we want to think long term, we need to fail. But there's no, and scenario planning can help envisage that. So we can play with failure and feeling less ashamed. So these two things, cognition, cognitive and aspects and the fear of failure. And it would be my two strengths.
Scenarios for Tomorrow is produced by me, Megan Crawford, with invaluable feedback from Dr. Isabella Riza, Jeremy Creep, Brian Ego, and as always, my kids.
This is a production of the Futures and Analytics Research Hub and FAR Lab, affiliated with Edinburgh Napier Business School. You can find show notes, references, and transcripts at scenarios.farhub.org. That's scenarios.farhub.org. You can follow us across social media by searching for Scenario Futures, all one word. You can subscribe to Scenarios for Tomorrow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Today's track was composed by Rocket, whose links are provided in the show notes. This is Scenarios for Tomorrow, where tomorrow's headlines start as today's thought experiments.